think what I want to just add is that, TIFF is really a growth engine tool. And so what we've noticed is that communities that have adopted the use of TIFF, and especially, single site developer-backed TIFF, they're able to shift the risk associated with the project to the developer, but at the same time, right, not limit the ability for their communities to grow. So,
welcome to Right Around Real Estate, the show about how to passively invest like a pro. On each episode, I interview real estate experts who give their top investing advice, strategies, and tools, and I break down their insights into practical steps to avoid the pitfalls and make better investments. I want to help you passively invest like a pro. This is Ritter on Real Estate, and I'm your host, Kent Ritter. Hello, fellow investors, and welcome to another episode of Ritter on Real Estate, where we teach you how to passively invest like a pro. Today, my guest is Zhao Wu Wan. He's the managing partner of Hegeman Capital, and he manages their day-to-day operations, as well as leading all bond structuring and negotiations for the Hegeman Capital portfolio. Prior to joining Hegeman, Zhao was a principal at Fifth Third Securities, a regional investment banking firm, primarily focused on high-yield TIFF and municipal bond transactions in the Midwest. Zhao, thank you very much for being on the show today. Excited to have you here.
And it's always a pleasure. I'm really excited to be on the show, and hopefully your listeners can get some value from the conversation that we're going to have.
I mean, I'm completely positive that they will, because I think in today's environment, what you're working on specifically related to the TIFF financing and just creating these public-private partnerships that can spur development, with where construction costs are, I think are extremely timely. So I think this would be a great feather for folks to have in their cap as they look to go out and try to put projects together. And so guys, definitely make sure you're paying attention to this one. Xiao's got a ton of great experience here. But before we dig in any further, I gave kind of a high level of who you are, but tell us a little more about yourself. Tell us about Hegeman Capital and what you guys are out doing.
Sure. Like you said, Ken, I'm the managing director of Hegeman Capital. And primarily we are Hegeman Capital is a purchaser of developer-backed TIF bonds in the Midwest, primarily in Indiana. We're starting to expand into Ohio as well. So prior to joining Hegeman Capital, I was a principal at Fifth Third Securities, Fifth Third Capital Markets. And primarily had a focus in high yield municipal bonds, which is a category that a lot of folks don't really understand or aren't sort of venturing into. And part of it is, most municipal bond transactions are very, I would say, traditional, run of the mill, down the fairway, all the platitudes, right? And so they're highly rated. There's a ton of investors for it. Whereas I think the high yield space, you get the very sort of limited, side of the investors. Not a lot of people are interested in it because of the security risk. And so TIFF, especially developer-backed TIFF, kind of fell into that category. And so really this category kind of fell into my lap. The more and more I looked into it, the more I understood, really these TIFF transactions are real estate transactions. And in order to be a successful buyer of a TIFF, not only does the company that is looking to purchase the TIFF need to have an understanding of the real estate risk associated with a project, but also the municipal bond structuring element associated with the municipal bond. And so it's kind of a weird skill set. Not a lot of people put really those two things together. And so for me, really, I started getting really into it in late 2018, early 2019. Really joined Hegeman Capital in 2020 to run this division for them. And so historically, Hegeman has been a family office rooted in agriculture and real estate investment. So the Hegeman family was a prior owner of a company called Remington Seeds that had a significant market share in wholesale seed corn and soybean production. And so when the family decided to sell Remington Seeds in 2013, created a large liquidity event that allowed us to invest primarily in commercial real estate. And so, like I was saying earlier, in order to understand TIF, you kind of have to have that commercial real estate basis behind you. And so the family wanted to diversify their real estate holdings outside of just traditional multifamily real estate, retail, agriculture, and more into sort of these specialized products that I would say have a, you know, what we consider kind of a risk imbalance, where we think the risk of it, of the assets that we're purchasing on the bonds, is a little bit lower than what the real estate risks are. But, you know, there's definitely some yield there for us to be able to make a decent return. And so that's why we created Hagelman Capital, which is specifically buy developer-backed bonds on behalf of developers.
I gotcha. So, I mean, you guys are the purchasers of these bonds. The developers are essentially kind of the sellers of these bonds, or the municipality is that, you know, that's taking part in the transaction. And I want to cover more into that later on, kind of nuts and bolts and how this actually works. But let's start with just explain to everybody what does TIF mean, and what is a TIF bond?
Great question, Ken. You know, so at the root of it, a tax increment financing bond is a security instrument that sort of memorializes an investor's ability to receive the revenues associated with tax increment revenue. So then you take a step back further, right? What is a tax increment revenue? Really, what a tax increment revenue is, if you take a parcel of land that is completely vacant, it generates a, you know, certain amount of taxes. Probably not very much. Vacant land, there's no improvements on it. It's not going to generate a ton of taxes. The increment really is described as if a real estate investor like yourself or a developer comes in and purchases this plot of vacant land and puts a 200 unit apartment complex on it. The taxes on the 200 unit apartment complex is significantly higher than what just the taxes of the raw land is. And so the difference between the taxes on the 200 unit apartments and what was there before, in this case, raw land, that is the increment. So what the bond is essentially doing is memorializes that cash flow, the difference between taxes on the apartments versus the land, securitizes it, and it is essentially a capture of the value of that increment cash flow.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way of starting to explain kind of a complex topic, right? That there's a lot of terms in there that people probably aren't super familiar with. I think so how Zhao and I know each other is they're actually purchasing a TIF bond through a development that we're currently working on. And, you know, they've been a great partner through that process, really helping me through my first foray at this and helping explain how all these work and all the different nuances. And it's what you're taking is, like you said, that increased property tax. And what the town is doing is actually forgoing those future tax payments for a number of years, typically 20 to 25 years. And they're forgoing those future tax payments in order to incentivize the development of this new property, right? So the town or city believes that there's going to be value in having this, say, 200 unit apartment there. But they know that they need to help and they need to chip in and create this public-private partnership by chipping in to help the building get built, right? And so the town is forgoing those future tax payments for a number of years. And instead, that cash flow gets wrapped up in a bond and goes to a group like Hagelman, who can then purchase the future cash flows. They can pay the current, essentially present value of those future cash flows, then to the developer, like me, who gets to put money into the deal and gets essentially extra funding into that deal that makes the return profile more attractive to their investors, because then you have to go out and raise less equity for the deal. For example, if you would, maybe you can get a loan, perhaps it's an $18 million all-in deal. You can get a loan for $10 million. So you would need $8 million in equity. Well, maybe when you look at the returns, they're not where they would need to be to attract $8 million of equity to that deal, to get people to come in and have a return that is required to meet the risk of doing that new development. But if that, but say you're now able to get a $2 million payment into the deal from the TIF bond, right? If you could put $2 million into that deal, the amount of equity you have to raise now becomes six, and it drastically increases the returns because the returns are only expected on $6 million. Same returns, same cash flow, same sale price right at the end, spread across $6 million versus being spread across $8 million, right? So you're increasing the returns for all of your equity investors by doing that, by being able to bring this TIF piece into the deal. And that's why it's so important, especially right now in the environment where construction costs have gone up significantly in the last 2 years. And really, almost any developer will tell you, if you're doing a market rate development, it's almost impossible to get that to pencil out without some sort of incentive financing, some sort of public-private partnership, partnering with the municipality in something like a TIF or a grant or some other form. So I think it's extremely important for you, for folks to understand this if they want to be developers, if they want to build the, you know, and start new construction right now, to be exploring this type of relationship and really working closely with the municipalities to understand what type of options are available. And then you got to find a buyer. You've got to find somebody to buy it, which is like the Hegeman Group, right? One way to do it is you go to a bank and you get financing. But the bank is not going to give you the same amount of proceeds as a group like Hegeman would. And so that's where I found tremendous value in bringing them in to buy the bond, because they've done it a million times. They've got a ton of expertise. They can help smooth out the process. And the Hegeman, I mean, their name, especially in the Midwest, carries a lot of weight as a family office. And so groups know that they're going to do what they say and they're going to get things done. And so that's the value I saw in doing this. So I think starting to explain what that TIF is, why it's so important. Zhao, can you talk a little bit more about how, you know, how that fits into the deal and how you've seen, I guess, that TIF piece really expand development, maybe just around whether it's Indianapolis or broader, kind of your purview of what the ability to bring that TIF financing in has done to development?
Sure. Yeah. You know, Ken, I think you alluded to a lot of these points earlier on. And I think what I want to just add is that, you know, TIF is really a growth engine tool. And so what we've noticed is that communities that have adopted the use of TIF, and especially, you know, single site developer backed TIF, they're able to shift the risk associated with a project to the developer. But at the same time, right, not limit the ability for their communities to grow. So places like Carmel and Fishers, you know, are great examples of these suburban communities that have really grown at the pace that nobody can anticipate, you know, because of the use of TIF. But I think for developers, it's ultimately important to have a level of sort of involvement with TIF. Because right now in our current development environment, land costs are significantly higher than they were before. Material costs are much higher. Interest rates are higher. And all of it really compounds to a worse return for, you know, both the LP investors and the GP investors. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of always say there, you know, there is a minimum yield requirement for any development to pencil. And I think that is a discussion in which you couldn't raise the money if the yield was too low, and which makes sense, right? No investor wants to take on development risk for a yield that is below X. And so the question there is, how can you increase your yield based on sort of all these parameters being limited, right? You can only cut costs a certain amount. Your land costs can only be so low, right? Labor costs can only be so low. And at some point, you know, you sort of value engineered your project to the point where you can't cut anymore, but there is still a gap between what your current returns are versus what your returns need to be in order to attract investors, attract banks to be able to do the project. That is really the gap that TIF is meaning to fill, right? This is the capital infusion in which the municipality is getting a sort of a density or a vibrant development or a parking garage in some cases, in areas that they want to develop, build that critical mass. But in order for that project to be started, there needs to be sort of this vortex that's applied that without this TIF dollar, this project doesn't occur, right? I think a lot of developers are in that position, especially in Indianapolis, that development projects just don't work without some form of incentive, right? Now, the degree of incentive, I think, is ultimately, what we're talking about here in regards to TIF, right? With a single side developer backed bond, right? The municipality, back then traditionally backed the TIF bonds with their own balance sheet. But I think as municipalities sort of looked more and more into that practice, realized that practice was not prudent to the risk profile. And so really shifted that risk, to the developers to support their own bonds. And so in doing this, right? What it's really created is, while developments are happening, prior to us entering into the marketplace to buy these developer-backed bonds, there really wasn't anybody doing it. So it was almost like if nobody really gave you a TIF, right? So we outlined sort of why TIF is important. We outlined why developers need TIF to fill the gap. But, it created a separate issue of who's able to monetize that TIF in order to fill that gap. And really, that's the role that Hagama Capital wants to come in and play as, is that it'd be really to contribute to the capital stack, at the onset of the project. So, what this is saying is, TIF in a nutshell is an extremely powerful tool. But I think what developers need to be aware of is the nuances of TIF are ultimately what's going to make and break your project, what's going to turn sort of a viable project, into a fantastic project. It's just this, how do you access and utilize TIF in the most efficient fashion?
Yeah, I think that's well said. And you hit on a couple of things there that I want to unpack a little bit more. The first one being, this idea of a town or municipality backed bond versus a developer backed bond. And you mentioned that you're kind of moving from one to the other. You've seen the market move from one to the other, but can you describe a little more the differences and then kind of how that change has occurred? And then so when people are approaching it now, what should they be expecting?
Sure. Ken, as you know, locally, right? I would say about 5 to 10 years ago, when a municipality would give TIF, it was primarily municipal backed TIF. And what that meant was that, regardless of how well the project does or doesn't do, the bondholder was going to get paid back by the tax revenues from the entire city or the entire allocation area, or TIF district, in which it's really just the taxpayers that are not associated with the project themselves. So in this environment, right, bondholders obviously love this because they're able to get essentially a municipal bond, right? Mm-hmm. It's labeled as TIF, but it's really supported by the credit of the municipality. And so I think as municipalities do more and more of these projects, they kind of realize, they don't really want to be in the practice of supporting a developer's project with their own balance sheet, right? So if you take a project and let's say it doesn't do well, doesn't generate a lot of increments, the bondholder in that sort of city-backed bond scenario is going to get paid back by other revenue sources outside of what the increment of the project is. Right. So there is sort of this risk off, this risk on basis where, mm-hmm. you know, if a project doesn't do well, the broader taxpayers of the municipality is really, they're on the hook, right? So the shift to developer-backed bonds is something that we've noticed in the last, 5 years. And, you know, we've noticed municipalities are going to slowly but surely saying no to city-backed bonds, but instead wanting to use developer-backed bonds. And so what I mean by a developer-backed bond is the repayment of the bond is purely based on the tax increment revenue from the developer's project and nothing else. So if the projected revenues come below, the developer essentially has to make up that extra payment, not the remaining taxpayers in the municipality. So obviously this is a less of a secure position for, bond buyers that really relying on a single taxpayer instead of sort of the broader credit of the municipality. And that is really where that sort of, risk pendulum have shifted, right? We went from really highly rated municipal instruments to, non-rated bonds that, are supported by a single developer or a single project.
And that's where a unique buyer like you guys, I think, really is important, because you said a municipal backed bond, there's many more traditional buyers out there, right? Because you're being backed by the full balance sheet of the town, of the city. But when you shift to developer backed, I imagine there's just, like you said, there's not as many traditional bond purchasers out there, right? And so you end up at this place potentially where you've got the town to agree that they will give you the bond, but really from there's a couple options, right? You're going to hold it yourself as the developer, or you're going to be able to sell that. And maybe talk about that piece of it, of kind of the traditional, and if you were as a developer to choose to hold it yourself, kind of what would, what does that look like essentially? What does that provide the developer, and what are risks versus selling that, and kind of the value that provides? Why would you choose to sell it versus hold it, et cetera? And kind of illuminate that for us.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question, Ken. And I think this is the same calculus that you went through as you were looking at your project. But ultimately, right, in a developer-backed bond scenario, there's a couple of options a developer can undertake. And really, prior to Hagaman Capital entering into the marketplace to buy these developer-backed bonds, these options were even more limited. So in the scenario in which a developer has to hold this bond, right, what they would do is that instead of collecting sort of a get a check, up front to be able to use as their equity, they have to now essentially clip coupons on the project for the next 20 to 25 years. And now, I think while a lot of your listeners understand sort of these abatements, abatements in general, right? Mm-hmm. TIF in a lot of ways is probably just seen as a longer term abatement. It's just that, with any sort of these cash flows, it's not something you can underwrite within your NOI. Right. So this concept that of NOI, it has to be, income in perpetuity, as long as the asset is existing.
Yeah.
TIF is not the case, right? TIF does have a sunset date in which after that date, there is no income, there is no revenue. Yeah. And so if a developer ends up holding the bonds, they're really not able to sort of capture the value of, of that cash flow. But instead, what they're required to do is, because it's sort of treated as an additional, additional debt, they have to come up with additional equity in order to sort of finance the bonds or purchase the bond. And so what that does is, it actually increases the required equity that needs to be put into a project. Mm-hmm. So really for a lot of developers that look to hold their bond, The idea is that a bond return is going to be less than a real estate return. So in a blended return scenario, holding your bond is a drag on your real estate return.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense, yeah.
Where selling the bond, though, if you look at it from a real estate lens, is no different than selling land or selling real estate at a, sort of pre-negotiated cap rate, right? The sale, really what it comes down to, right, is, a buyer like us and a developer like you, you know, agree on a certain price that the bonds need to be sold at. And so, you know, upon the sale, what we would do is essentially provide that equity to, you know, to the developer upfront. You know, we typically like to close with the construction lender. Our money comes in after the equity. But for all intents and purposes, we expect that our capital for the TIF is going to be drawn before the loan proceeds. So what a lot of banks will do is essentially see this and capture it as equity, right? It is dollars before them. It is equity in the capital stack. And so the opposite is true, that now you need to find less equity or contribute less equity to go into a project, as opposed to sort of the other scenario, which is contribute more equity because you're trying to finance a cash flow that is essentially not an NOI consideration.
Right.
So, you know, kind of another pain point for a lot of developers that, you know, end up holding their own bonds is that over the next however many years, right, they may have a refinancing event in which, if interest rates go up, now, you know, the refinancing proceeds are not enough to pay off the initial loan on the bond itself, right? So then now you're eating into the capital stack or the capital refinancing of the real estate loan just to cover essentially the losses on the bonds, right? Yeah. So you're limiting some of the appreciation of the property.
If I can interject, because it's relevant, that was a big, in my consideration of saying, you know, because my first path was I'm going to go finance this bond, right? And that's how I'm going to get the upfront proceeds. Before I talked with you, I got referred to your group, and the value, that interest rate risk in today's environment was a big piece of that value proposition as I was thinking about doing this, right? Was because essentially, instead of worrying about an interest rate reset in 5 years and not knowing what that would be and having to worry about that, I knew that I could just, you know, essentially wash my hands of the bond, you know, by selling it outright to you guys, instead of having to worry about that potential risk in the future and what that might do to degrade those returns. And really just the entire process of monitoring and collecting on the bond and managing cash flow, because I think it's important for people to understand while it is similar to a tax abatement, you're still paying the taxes. You have to have the cash flow up front. The property still pays the taxes. If you hold the bond, the way it'll work is the property pays the taxes, and then about a month later, you'll receive the taxes back as the bond proceeds, but you still have to have the cash flow up front. So it's not like you can just, as you said, it's not something to factor into your NOI. And that was a trap that I fell in inaccurately upfront too, as I was looking at it as, oh, you can just juice your NOI. You don't have to pay these property taxes. And as I educated myself, that's not the case. The property still has to be able to support the taxes, because that's ultimately what's paying the bond. And you still have to have that cash flow to support that, because you're going to have a gap to when that money actually goes out and then comes back to you. And so, as you said, I think it's, you know, it's wrong for people to think that, oh, they can increase the value of their property,
right,
by the amount of the decreased taxes, because as you correctly stated, your property and NOI is going to be valued over here, and that bond is going to be valued over here. And the value of that bond is going to be, the multiple on that is much less than on the property, right? And so you've got to really value, right, those things differently as you would look to even sell it on the other end. So these are just things, as I learned how this would all really work, it was just, wow. Sometimes, and another developer friend of mine actually said, you know, sometimes there's enough moving parts in these developments, you just want to hit the easy button on a couple things. And this was my way to really hit the easy button and be able to wash my hands of that. Because really my game is not to make money on these financial instruments and trying to play this bond game, right? It's really to get the money into the deal to increase the real estate returns. And I think that was the big value that I saw in going to a buyer like yourself versus going to a traditional bank and trying to finance.
Well, yeah, Ken, I mean, you're spot on. I appreciate you saying that too. You know, I think something that we always like to do, right, is that we are also real estate investors ourselves. And so, you know, we've been in kind of the exact same situation as you have been. You know, prior to starting Hagaman Capital, there was kind of a thought that, you know, could we hold the bond within the real estate and juice NOI? And the short answer really is, it really shouldn't happen, and a good appraiser would probably see that and say that that's not a point of NOI, right? It's the same thing. An abatement don't count. This is just a longer abatement. So, you know, why would it be sort of a, you know, considered as an NOI? But I think the other sort of less nuanced point that, you know, folks don't always see is that, you know, expenses on your real estate project, like taxes, is deductible. If it comes back to you as an income on a bond, right, that has a separate tax treatment as well, right?
That's a good point. Really good point. Yeah.
And I think it's kind of understated, but the reality is, right, you know, interest on, you know, I'm not a CPA, so, you know, here's sort of the weasel language, consult the CPA, right?
That's right.
You know, I think in a lot of ways, right, when, you know, when you are getting income, you know, back as a interest on the bond, that interest is taxed at, you know, I believe it's ordinary income.
That's right.
And so, you know, and that's not something that you can easily deduct, right? So it's not, so not only is it not NOI, the income you receive back from holding the bond is taxed at a different rate than what potentially your real estate is taxed at, because of sort of this, you can't really, it's not an offset deduction. So,
yeah.
You know, that's sort of one of those more kind of hidden points of it, but, you know, really the overarching point is, right, in an environment of volatility, regardless of rates go up and go down, right, you're sort of in a position, if you sell a long-term asset, you're in a better position to sell long-term assets today because of not only, you know, not only the interest rate risk, but because of how inverted the yield curve is, right? So, you know, when we price a bond, I think, as you're aware, right, we are pricing a bond to a 10-year yield curve, and right now the yield curve inversion, the 2-10 inversion, is somewhat historic. Right, we just don't see ratios, you know, of this caliber, you know, where the 2 is outpacing the 10 by this much, and it's somewhat historic. And so, really, what, you know, as developers hope interest rates come down, they're really saying it's short-term interest rates that are coming down, right? The Federal Reserve essentially had no control over, you know, limited control over the long-term interest rates. And so that, you know, as short-term interest rates come down, it does not mean that long-term interest rates will follow too. It may, the counter may be true, to have more sort of a stabilized and normal shape yield curve, that long-term interest rates may actually have to go up in order for short-term interest rates to come down. And so there is sort of this nuance too about selling your bonds today is not only the interest rate risk component of it, but really is that you're taking advantage of a historically, you know, historically inverted yield curve, and that selling a long-term asset yields a certain advantage.
Yeah. Now, I think that's a really good point on why it's an excellent time to look into this. So I think for people to understand, I mean, at the end of the day, and I've just gone through this process with a development that we're working on. You know, we're about to put a shovel in the ground on 80 units, ground up development, where the Hagaman Group is buying our TIF bond on this project. But I've also talked to enough other developers out there to just know that if you're underwriting expenses accurately, where construction expenses have gone and land prices have gone, these market rate projects just don't work unless you have a component of, you know, something like a TIF bond or a grant or a piece that's coming in to supplement equity that doesn't require a return or the same return as your LP investors would expect, right? The deals just don't pencil out. I've looked at enough of them. So I think that's why it's so critical, if you're trying to do development at this point, to make sure you understand the tools like TIF bonds that can help you get deals done, can build a partnership with the town and get them bought in, and help you continue to give market, I guess, attractive returns to your investors are going to allow you to raise that equity, right? So really important that we understand how this works. I think this is a perfect intro overview, kind of a good 101. The other thing, Xiao, I wanted to ask you was, so folks are maybe they've got a project, they're looking at land, they want to do a development. They're like, wow, we got to look into TIFs. Like, how should folks start? Like, what's the first step down the path that they can start exploring this with their local municipality? How do they approach them?
Sure. You know, I think this is sort of where I outline a lot of disclaimer language, but it's not like your typical legal disclaimer. I think it's sort of more as, you know, our responsibilities as placemakers and developers and capital providers of, you know, we need to do the best we can for the community, right? And I think really the first step for all developers is that they need to understand why they're asking for TIF. You know, and the idea is that it shouldn't purely just be, you know, something that juices your return. Obviously, that's a really important component. Mm-hmm. But really what you're providing is, you know, you want to sort of make a case and you want to create a product too, right? That is the easiest way to make a case that is accretive to the community that you're asking for the TIF.
Yeah.
You know, what people don't want to do is ask for TIF for somewhat uninspired projects, ask for TIF in, you know, sort of areas that, you know, really you don't need TIF to make the project work, right? I think those types of conversations, not only does it make it harder for the rest of the development community to, you know, get TIF, it makes it harder for your case to be sort of, you know, built, right? So really the first step is understand why you need TIF. Right. If there is a, you know, the easiest way is there is a huge need for housing in that community. There's a huge need for maybe high quality housing in that community or public parking, or they want to sort of a, you know, revitalize their downtown. Right. But in order for you to embark on that project and really place make, you have to have TIF in order to make the project work, right? I think that is a great narrative, right? So first step is to build a narrative of why you're asking for TIF. But then also understand, you know, you really need community buy-in from, you know, city staff and also from city council members, right? This is to really sort of build the case and then present the case. The highest level, it truly is understand why you need TIF, but you know, and be able to present that case and to really understand how much TIF you need, right? Understand how much your project can generate in terms of incremental revenue. But then also understand this is how much my project will need in order to clear a return hurdle that an investor is willing to sign off on, right? Yeah. I think without that, without sort of those three prongs, you know, your argument, I think, is going to be, you know, just not as strong as if you had sort of all these things in mind and understand why you're asking for, who you're asking for, or who you're asking it from, and then how much you're asking for.
Yeah, I think those are really good points. And just from my own experience of just going through this over the past year and a half, I think what you said about building relationships with the folks in the town or city, right? The folks on the council, maybe town manager, town planner, or in a city, you know, the equivalent folks. First off, before you come with your ask, is critical, right? Build that relationship, explain your project, and then presenting it as like you said, really the last dollar's in, right? So you've done the work, you know that, you know, it's going to cost this much to build your project, right? Because you want to build a high quality building with great finishes, right? You don't just want to build a run of the mill, low quality product. But because maybe it's more, a more rural market, right? Where there is a demand for housing, but you're not able to get the highest rents as you would in downtown, you know that your project, you know, you can only, the cost you can afford to keep the return, palatable to investors is only here, right? So you're here to here, you've got this gap. And I think that's a really effective way to communicate it, is you need to be able to close this gap. So you could build, you know, the Vinyl Village or whatever you're going to for here, but you want to deliver the quality of product that's up here. And that's what the town wants as well. They want a high quality product. But you need help filling that gap to get there. And I think that shows that you've built the relationships, you've done the thoughtful work, you know what the costs are, you know the gap, and being able to communicate that, I think is a really effective way to get them on board to say, yeah, we could build the run of the mill here, but we're trying to do better than that, right? But we need your help to do better than that. And I think that's a really powerful way to show them you've thoughtfully thought through this and kind of triangulate those points, as you said. And I think also on the other side, it's really critical to understand what size of a TIF can your project support? And really what that comes down to is how much property tax can your project support, right? Because at the end of the day, when you're doing a developer-backed bond, you're going to sign a minimum taxpayer agreement that essentially locks you in on a floor for what your property taxes are. And so no matter what, you're going to pay that amount. And you've got to be comfortable that your project can support that based on what it's going to be assessed for at the end of the day and how much property taxes that's going to generate. Or as a developer in a developer-backed bond, what you're signing up to is come out of pocket to make that bondholder whole and pay that additional amount. So if your property, is only going to assess for $150,000 in property taxes a year, but you sign up for a minimum taxpayer agreement of $180,000, that additional $30,000 is going to come out of the developer's pocket. So I think it's important to understand what that risk is. And that's also going to determine the amount of TIF bond that you want to ask for. Because if you ask for a bond that requires you to pay $180,000 a year, then you've got to be comfortable potentially coming out of pocket for, in that example, a $30,000 gap, right? So lower the amount of the TIF bond in your ask, lower that minimum payment and that risk there. So you got to triangulate a lot of things as you're trying to figure this out. But I think the simplest way to communicate it to the town is that gap in quality and trying to bridge that gap and deliver a really high quality product. That can be a successful way to approach it, but only after you've got good relationships in place. You don't want to lead with the ask in anything, right? In life, yeah. I think start with the relationship first. But Michelle, this was awesome. I love the power session on TIF. Super important tool for any developer to have in their tool belt and understand it and be able to utilize it. Important for people to know that there's buyers out there like yourselves, because we don't want to hold on to it long-term in many cases. We've proven that point. You want to get that money into your deal up front. That's the true value creator. So thank you for enlightening us today. That's awesome.
Thank you very much.
Before I let you go, I got to take you through our lightning round. There's four questions I want to ask you. It's our keys to success. The first one is, and you're a very sophisticated investor, if you were going to invest in someone else's deal, right, you're going to put your money into that deal and you can only ask them one question. What is the one question that you would ask?
Kent, that's probably one of the best questions I've heard. It's an excellent question. I think that I'll sort of ask this question. I'll state the question and I'll caveat it why I would ask the question. And the question I would ask is, what is the most important trait you look for in a partner? And that is the question I would ask anybody I would potentially invest money with. And this I think the answer of the question tells me a lot about how the other party is really thinking about a deal, right? And for us, we're very sort of, this is a very, the Indianapolis development community, and I think you're really even amongst the Midwest, right, with capital and developers, it's really a community that is built on trust and reputation, right? And for us, the easiest way for us to not invest money with anybody is to know that they don't have the most stellar reputation, right? We only want to put money behind good people. And the reason is there is just so many potential issues that you can avoid by investing in the best people first. Right. If they're honest, good people, you just won't run into a lot of the issues that, dishonest, bad people may present, regardless of how good the deal is. Right. So first and foremost, right, is that is this component of sponsor risk that we want, when we ask this question, we want to know what is a sponsor, what is a thing that they really care about in their partner, and it'll illuminate whether or not we want to be their partner. So I don't know if that's a good answer for that question, but ultimately I think it's the way that we think about, you know, how we want to invest in somebody is to know that our values align and that, you know, they want, you know, what they want in a partner is essentially who we are as an investor.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent answer. And we've talked on this show a number of times about that sponsor risk. And, you know, it really does start with the sponsor. I mean, like we say, you know, a bad sponsor can kill a good deal and a good sponsor can save a bad deal. And I think that's absolutely true. So I think it gets to the heart of that. Ooh. Next question. What are you most proud of in your career?
I'm not one of those guys that sort of go back through a highlight reel of all the things that I do or haven't done. But, you know, I think the thing that I'm most proud of throughout my career has been the fact that I have, you know, I am able to still be a good husband and a good partner to my wife. And I think about, you know, the reason why we do anything that we do, and it's really for, you know, the people we love, right? And so I think what I sometimes don't know how to answer these types of questions is because the things that are really important to me is that at the end of the day, I'd rather be a good husband than be a good deal maker. But I think in this world, we can be both. And so I think that being able to achieve that balance has been the thing that I've been most proud of in my career.
That's an awesome answer. I love it. Straight from the heart, getting to really what's important and finding that balance. And I think that is something to be proud of. So yeah, absolutely. Next question is, what is a book that everybody should read?
You know, big fan of Malcolm Gladwell. So I think anybody that would ever ask me about, you know, but I don't read a ton of self-help books, but I would say, you know, I think anything by Malcolm Gladwell is really a must read, but if I were to pick one, you know, it would probably be Outliers. I think it's not only is it, there's just a lot of applicable lessons, it really changed the way that you look at the world. It makes you think about success differently, right? It's understanding that while I think there are truly talented people that are, you know, sort of way beyond our comprehension, there is just something really refreshing about, you know, anybody that is really successful at their art or their craft and spend a lot of time honing it, right? Mm-hmm. And that really for us, the barrier to entry in some of those things is really just time and energy and taking, you know, and practice, right? Get your reps in. I do really enjoy that book, and makes me feel like, you know, I can achieve more than I think I can achieve.
Awesome. I love that. I love that attitude. And last but not least, what is your number one key to success?
So yeah, that's a great question. I would say, you know, I wouldn't consider myself, you know, successful in that sense, but I think I'm sort of always on the path of, you know, getting there, right? But I think just through my journey, I think the things that have served me well have just been persistence. I would say I'm a pretty persistent individual that, you know, I do like to go after, you know, go after deals or go after things and, you know, be persistent, right? Is that, you know, get used to hearing no or get used to being rejected, and that's okay. But I think I want to add to that is that it's persistent with a good attitude and good character. Right. I think there's a lot of, you probably experienced this too with people that, you know, are, let's say in sales, for example, right? They're very persistent, but they may not do it in the nicest way. And at the end of it, you know, are they truly nice people? right? And so it's sort of being persistent with the mindset that at the end of the day, you still have to be a good person, right? You still have to be, you know, you're not just being persistent to sort of benefit yourself. You're being persistent because, you know, you really truly believe in what you're doing, but also, you know, doing it in a way that makes people feel like, you know, they're valued and, you know, at the end of the day, you feel good about yourself. So for me, it's really, you know, I don't know if that's two things or one, but, you know, that's just kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think persistence is critical. And then I love the aspect of, you know, doing it because not just for your own sake, but because, you know, maybe what you're doing is going to help the other people. Right. And you're in some ways helping people get out of their own way, by staying on them and being persistent. And, you know, I think the other thing that I've witnessed from you is just the willingness to kind of give beyond just the individual transaction, you know, and the willingness to, you know, kind of educate and help and kind of look for other things. Like, you know, there was an event that came up in this deal with me, right, where we had some financing that we had to shift and make another move. And I mean, you were the first one to reach out and say, hey, how can I help? Is there anybody I can connect you with? Is there, you know, any way that we can be of value there? And I thought that was, you know, I really appreciated that. And it just shows that there is that good person layer there. There's that caring beyond the individual transaction and what's going to be in it for you at the end of the day, but you're worried about making it all work and all being successful and keeping that deal together. So absolutely, you know, I experienced that and understand, that is truly a key to your success. So absolutely.
Well, hey, gosh, thank you so much for the kind words. I just, you know, I don't know if I deserve that, but, you know, just really appreciate, you know, what you have to say about our experiences and interactions together.
For sure. And I think that this is a great place to wrap up, Zhao. And as people want to, you know, understand what Hegeman Capital is doing, maybe they've got a TIF bond themselves that they'd like to look at potentially selling. How can folks reach out to you and learn more?
Sure. The easiest way to reach out to us is on our website, HagemanCapital.com, HagemanCapital.com. They can also reach us on LinkedIn, which is, we're just under Hageman Capital. And really, I think those two ways are the easiest way to get a hold of us.
Awesome. Well, with that, we'll wrap things up, Zhao. And I think great knowledge today on TIF bonds. I think for folks that were listening, you know, make sure you're taking away that this is a tool in the developer's tool belt. I think it's something that you've got to understand to really maximize the value in your deals as you're doing developments right now. And so listen to it again, catch some of those great nuggets that Zhao provided. And with that, yeah, we hope you have a great rest of the day. We'll link everything below so that folks can reach out to you. And we'll hopefully talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to another great episode of Ritter on Real Estate. Hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss out on the content that will make you a better investor. Also, visit KentRitter.com for articles, videos, and tools curated just for passive investors. Until next time, this is Kent Ritter with Ritter on Real Estate. Now go out and invest like a pro.